A therapy using sensory stimulation, like eye movements, is helping patients overcome trauma. We'll hear from a practitioner and someone who found it successful. And archaeologists have long said that Cahokia Mounds was abandoned by native communities in the 1400s. Today, researchers are using fecal deposits to show that those populations came back and could have been there centuries longer than we thought. But first, more than 770 former Illinois inmates may have had their voter registration mistakenly canceled.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up today on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Maxey. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear more about a therapy that uses sensory stimulation, like eye movements, to help patients overcome trauma. And Cahokia Mounds was abandoned by Native communities in the 1400s, but new research finds that Native populations came back to the area and could have been there for centuries longer than we realized. But first, on Monday, Iowans made their presidential pick in the nation's first primary. But you may have heard that a smartphone app issue got in the way of a smooth start to the 2020 general elections. That same day, Illinois also ran into an elections database snafu. Local election authorities were told that 774 former Illinois Department of Corrections inmates may have had their voter registration mistakenly canceled. That's according to the State Board of Education of Elections. The former inmates were incorrectly categorized as incarcerated after registering to vote upon completing their sentences. For the latest on all this, we're joined on the line now by Dan Petrella. He's the state government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Dan, welcome back to the 21st, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what were election authorities told on Monday about what happened to the voter registrations for these former inmates?
So this was a result of what they're calling a data matching error, where the Department of Corrections and the Board of Elections compare their data and try to find people who are currently incarcerated who have their voting rights suspended while they're serving their prison sentences. And as you said, these 774 people were incorrectly identified as having been incarcerated when they had in fact completed their sentences, were released from prison, and had re-registered to vote.
And this problem was actually detected back in November due to a data matching error. And what is that exactly what you're talking about? What does that exactly mean?
Yes. So, you know, as they compare their list of registered voters with their list of people who are in custody in the Department of Corrections, there was some sort of mistake in the computer system where these people were incorrectly identified. The State Board of Elections has said that they should have been able to vote if they went to the polls, either through the provisional ballot system where you can say, well, I'm not showing up on the voter rolls, but I am registered, and then you have a few days to prove your registration. Or there's also in Illinois now a system of same-day voter registration. So they're hopeful that people, you know, if they showed up to the polls in previous elections, still were able to vote, but there's no way of guaranteeing that.
Mm. And were these inmates from all over the state?
Yes, there were 774. About a third of them were in Cook County, and then you know the collar counties, DuPage, Lake, McHenry, and Kane had many others, but they were scattered throughout the state in about half of the 108 different election jurisdictions around the state.
And what did the what was the response from the Illinois State Board of Elections about it?
They were the ones who publicized the issue. They wanted to bring it to people's attention. They notified local election authorities. They're hoping that this information can get out to the people who may have had their registration canceled, so that they can get registered to vote in the primaries, which are coming up. Early voting started today.
Right. The announcement about these mistaken cancellations also comes as state lawmakers prepared for a hearing yesterday on unrelated issues with the state's automatic voter registration program. Illinois state Republicans are calling for suspending that program. Can you walk us through some of the problems we've seen recently with the program?
Yes. So there have been several problems with the automatic voter registration program, which is done through the Secretary of State's office when people come into driver services facilities. The perhaps most noteworthy of which is that 545 people who checked a box on a touchscreen saying that they weren't U.S. citizens still had their information transmitted to the State Board of Elections. And it's been determined now, the number has been changing a little bit, but it's 16 people actually voted in elections in November of 2018 and spring of 2019. And we know now that one of those people right there in Champaign County was, in fact, not a U.S. citizen and voted in the general election in November of 2018.
And just out of curiosity, is this something that you think is happening all over the country? I know you're covering Chicago and Illinois, but is it only Illinois that is having these issues?
Super familiar with the automatic voter registration programs in other states, but one of the issues here in Illinois that came to light at that hearing yesterday that you mentioned is that, when you go in for a standard driver's license to the Secretary of State's facility, you don't have to show any documents proving citizenship, because being a citizen is not a requirement to get a driver's license. You just have to live in the state and show your residence and things like that. So the Secretary of State's office doesn't really know when you come to get a driver's license whether or not you are a citizen. So they're relying on people to report whether they are a citizen when they go through the voter registration process. There's now the Real ID, which is a more secure form of driver's license. It's going to be required later this year for people who want to board airplanes, for example. And that does require you to prove citizenship. So that can really be true automatic voter registration, where you show your documents and then they send your information along to the State Board of Elections. Although there have been some hiccups there as well, with people who have said, no, I don't want to register, and still had their information sent along.
And then there was a problem with some 16-year-olds as well?
That's correct. So the Secretary of State's office had decided to send information on 16-year-olds to the State Board of Elections with the thinking that in Illinois, you can vote in a primary if you're 17 years old and will be 18 by the next general election. And there are circumstances under which, you go in July of 2019 to get your driver's license. You're 16 years old. You turn 17 in August, so you'll be 17 for the upcoming primary. And then in August of 2020, you turn 18, and then you can vote in the November election. But the State Board of Elections, because 16-year-olds are not allowed to register to vote, they just blocked all those registrations from being sent to the local election authorities. And the Secretary of State's office has now said that they won't send that information along to the Board of Elections anymore.
All right. Well, we just have a minute left, but I did want to ask you about voting issues kind of generally. The issue we saw in Iowa this week is not the same as the ones we're having, the problems we're having in Illinois. But I do think it's a good reminder that the mechanics of elections are just so, so important. I mean, it really is the bedrock of our democracy. And I'm just wondering what you think the mood is and what you're keeping your eye on.
I spoke to the local county clerk in Champaign County briefly yesterday, and he, assured me that people should have faith in the integrity of the process. But, it's understandable if people have worries given what's come to light over the last few weeks here in Illinois, the situation in Iowa, the efforts in 2016 by the Russian government to hack the voter registration database here in Illinois. And just in general, there's a lot of outdated voting equipment around the state of Illinois. And people have been trying for a long time to get the federal government to provide some more money to update that stuff, but it hasn't been coming. And, that's a big need for local counties and other election authorities to update some of their equipment.
I got it. Well, that is all the time we have for today. So I just want to let you know that's Chicago Tribune reporter Dan Petrella. He's been updating us on some of the voter registration issues we've been having here in Illinois. Dan, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. We really
thanks
appreciate
so much for
it.
Having me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. Later this hour, we'll hear from researchers working in the field of EMDR therapy. That stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. It's a form of treatment for people who've suffered trauma. It's been around since the 1980s, and I became aware of it back in March 2013 when I packed up my car with two of my children and drove from Evanston, Illinois to Washington, D.C. to visit friends over spring break. Since I'd lived there for almost 9 years, I had a lot of people to see. Top of that list was one of my best friends, Alice, who I'd known for 25 years. We arranged to meet for coffee on the morning of March 26th at 9 a.m. As usual, I arrived early and waited. When she wasn't there at 9, I didn't really think anything of it. But at 9:15, I was a little worried and texting, "So, are you running late?" And by 9:30, I was texting, "I'm worried. Call me ASAP." No call came. I got in the car to leave, and I called her house on the off chance she was home. A stranger answered. It was her cousin, who told me that Alice had been run over by a van and was in the hospital. I drove to Baltimore right away, where Alice was in surgery to stabilize her pelvis, which was shattered. In the coming weeks and months, Alice would undergo another surgery, 8 hours long, intensive rehab, and a year lost to recovery and various therapies. She, her husband, and two children even had to move into an apartment because there were too many stairs in her house. It was a long, long year. But I am thrilled to be able to tell you that now Alice is absolutely fine. If you met her, you would never know she'd been through such a trauma. And that is true due to the miracles of modern medicine, of course, but also to EMDR that has a remarkable success rate for people with PTSD. Whether the PTSD stems from battle, trauma, adverse childhood events, or any other difficulty. The therapy has to do with retraining the brain to make the active emotional trigger of a trauma become a passive memory by using sensory stimulation. I invited Alice to come to the show today to tell us more about her experience with EMDR, and she's on the line. Alice, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Gwen. It's strange to hear that story from your side.
I know. And since we've worked together a lot before, but we've never interviewed one another, so also a little strange.
True.
Does the accident seem longer than 7 years ago to you now? Because I can't believe it's already been 7 years.
You know, it depends on the day. Sometimes it seems it was another lifetime ago. And a lot of times, though, it's very present in my life and, feels like it was last year. So go figure.
Yeah. So I'm trying to remember exactly, where were you in your recovery when you heard about EMDR, and how did you hear about it?
I had vaguely heard of it before, but didn't really know what it was. And when I got out of the hospital, which was 7 weeks after the accident, I was in a wheelchair. And so, as you said in your introduction, my family had moved to an apartment, and a friend came to take me out for lunch. And we got to the corner, and she was going to help wheel me across the street. And so there was not a red, there was like a flashing yellow light. So we were just waiting for an opportunity to cross. And every time a car went by, apparently I was flinching. And she finally turned to me and said, "Wow, you seem really traumatized just, being around a car. Maybe you should consider this therapy that I did a number of years ago." And so we went to lunch, and she told me about her experience with it. And she actually had her son treated for anxiety, a very small kid. I think he was 12, 11 years old, something like that. And they had found it tremendously successful. So she passed along the name of her EMDR therapist, and I went about it. Although I have to say, I was in just regular therapy at the time and before the accident, and both my therapist and my doctor were clearly really skeptical about it. They knew what it was and were skeptical, but I really needed help, and so I just plowed on.
And how would you describe your experience with PTSD before the therapy?
That is very hard to talk about. It's something I almost have never talked about, but I was actually stayed conscious through the accident. And it was right across the street from my house, as you know, and a neighbor was coming around the corner and I was walking my dog, and I thought he was slowing, waiting for me to finish crossing the corner. And when I realized the car was basically upon me, I tried to dive to the side and to get back out of the street. And then he drove over me and in a minivan. And so there was this moment where I was still awake, where I was conscious that the back tires were going to go over me next. And that was the moment that I just kept reliving in my head before I went to EMDR.
That was my good friend, Alice Winkler, talking about a traumatic car accident she was involved in 7 years ago. After the break, we'll hear about Alice's experience with EMDR and hear from a clinical psychologist who's used EMDR therapy with her patients. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. We're talking about a form of therapy to help people who've suffered from trauma. It's called EMDR, which stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. I've been speaking with my friend Alice, who used the therapy to help recover from painful memories after being run over by a van and airlifted to the hospital. This was on a morning when we were supposed to meet, as I was visiting her from Illinois. Later this hour, we'll hear from a psychologist who's trained in the therapy to learn more about why researchers think it helps patients. But first, we wanted to get back to Alice's story. So what was your experience with the EMDR therapy like?
Well, it sounds so kooky.
I know, right.
I mean, the therapist was a very experienced person. She's actually retired since from doing the therapy, but she was a professor of psychology at GW, and in her private practice, she did this. And so I went to see her, and she explained as best as she could what we were going to do. And then she gave me a choice of the sensory input that I could have. And the traditional one, which is where the name EMDR came from, was eye movement. So there's rectangular box, and it sits more or less on a tripod, and there are a series of little lights that, you know, faced me, and the lights would sort of run from left to right, like little almost Christmas bulbs size lights, and they would go from right to left. And then I also had the choice of an auditory input. I chose not to do that, basically because, like you, I worked in radio and didn't want to mix it up with audio. I just stayed away from that. And then the third choice was some kind of touch sensor where they would, I think, hook your fingers up to something so you'd feel a buzzing. But anyway, I chose the light. And then the therapist brought me through a series of exercises where she would, you know, it's sort of like what you think of as exposure therapy. You know, she would have me recall the incident, but I would do that while I was watching these lights go back and forth. So I had to follow the lights and then at the same time in my head go to that, you know, really traumatic moment that was the PTSD moment. And then we would, you know, I would do that for some amount of time, then we'd stop and we'd talk through it. And then she'd say, let's start, you know, we're going to start again, pick that up and just let your mind go wherever it wants. And my mind went to some pretty interesting places during that. I remember at one point, you know, when we'd stop and she'd say, what were you thinking about? And I was, you know, I started with the moment under the car and then somehow imagined that I had, you know, this sort of bionic shield over my back that had kept me from dying under the car. And can't really remember too many specific other thoughts, but that one felt very powerful. It felt, and this was only maybe my second or third visit with her, where I felt like somehow mentally that I had developed some shield or some superhuman powers that I had survived this terrible thing. And I actually didn't do it that many times. I continued to see her for a little while, you know, a couple months, but I didn't actually do the light movement part of it, the eye movement part of it for very long. But the effect was so dramatic, so quickly. I mean, I had a, you know, pretty good experience with traditional psychotherapy. And this was just, you know, there was no sort of long tail to it. It was, you know, I was having that that sort of PTSD memory over and over of being under the car. And then I did this thing a couple of times and it really shifted quickly, which is, you know, when you have a trauma, that's really what you're looking for.
How did the difference manifest itself? Was it sort of an everyday life just got better, or was it specific? I mean, obviously it was specific to the accident, but how did things differ after that?
Well, it's interesting. I remember Sylvia, the therapist, explaining to me that you could think of the therapy as metabolizing the experience so that it would become a memory. In other words, I was re-experiencing it, the accident, over and over. And so it was, I couldn't handle it, right? It was like I was back under the car every time. And so what she meant by metabolizing it was, you know, if you imagine digesting it, that, you know, when you've experienced something normally, it very quickly becomes a memory. You don't forget it, but you don't re-experience it. But with PTSD, what happens is you keep re-experiencing it and you have all of the body sensations that go along with experience. You know, your heart's racing, or you have an adrenaline rush, or you're, you know, sobbing, or the things that you experience when you're really in the middle of experiencing something. And when you remember it, it can be very powerful, but it doesn't have all those, you know, other physical, biological components that go with that. And I went back to my therapist and my doctor and said, this is what it did. You know, I know you were skeptical, but you were wrong.
I was just about to ask you if you went back to them.
I did, both of them. I told them, if you ever have a patient with another trauma, just know that at least for me, and for a lot of people who've done it, it's a very powerful thing.
Yes, and I also just have to say that you're one of the most grounded and skeptical people I know. So when
yes,
you...
I am not woo woo about alternative
anything.
Treatments.
So
that is true.
So yeah, and in fact, I had kind of heard of it before you, but when you told me that it was helpful, that gave it a lot more weight to me.
I remember the therapist telling me, you know, that this will, of course, anyone who's had a trauma would like to think that they could forget it, or that it could, that it would recede into the background. And so I remember her saying, you know, like, that's not going to happen. this therapy isn't going to make that happen. You know, this accident will always be part of your story. But, you know, what the therapy will do is help, will help do just that, turn it into, you know, part of your story and not part of your everyday experience.
Well, Al, thank you so much for being willing to talk about this and to tell your story and to be on the show. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for asking me, Gwen. It's not easy to talk about, but happy if it helps somebody else.
That was Alice Winkler recalling her experience with EMDR therapy after a traumatic car accident and injury. Now I'd like to welcome another guest. Louise Maxfield is a clinical psychologist and founding editor-in-chief of the Journal of EMDR Practice and Research. She was trained in EMDR in 1993 and has been using it with her clients since. She also worked with Francine Shapiro, who pioneered the therapy. Louise is on the phone with us now from London, Ontario, Canada, where I understand it is also very snowy right now, like much of Illinois, and she's here to answer some of our questions. Welcome to the 21st, Dr. Maxfield.
Thank you very much, Gail.
I have so many questions, but I'm just going to jump right in. Do we know what's happening in the brain during the therapy that allows people to, as Alice said, metabolize the memory of a traumatic event?
Yes. Well, there is some evidence now showing that there is a reduction in the activity in the limbic system and in the reactivity of the amygdala, and an increase in activity in the frontal lobes of the brain and the more cognitive areas. And so there's a very noticeable change that happens in the brain with the successful treatment.
And so we know that it's successful. We can see that in the brain. Do we know why it works?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think we probably don't necessarily really know why any psychotherapy is effective. There's been some dismantling studies with EMDR looking at some of the effects of eye movements in particular. And we found that eye movements make memories less vivid and less emotional, and that they also help to people to recall other aspects of memories, make more associations. They're also relaxing. So there's quite a bit of power in eye movements, and we think that might be part of the reason why EMDR has been found to be such an efficacious treatment.
That's so interesting to me. And do we know what kind of trauma it works best on, or has it been successful for lots of different traumas, categories of trauma and problem?
It's very successful with all kinds of trauma, from things like motor vehicle accidents like Alice had, and military combat, sexual violence, childhood abuse, disasters. What we do know is that for a one-time trauma such as what Alice went through, it tends to be very rapid, just two or three sessions, and the trauma becomes just an old memory. But people who've had really extensive trauma that affected the way they lived their life, that requires more lengthy treatment.
That's so interesting that it can work so quickly. How you worked with Dr. Shapiro, who was the pioneer of the therapy. Do you know how it was discovered that this kind of sensory stimulation can help patients?
Well, it's kind of a unique thing. She was walking in the park one day and she was thinking about something that was bothering her, and as she was walking, all of a sudden, she noticed that her emotional had really dissipated, and she thought, what's going on? And then she realized that she'd been moving her eyes rapidly back and forth. And so she thought, well, maybe there's something to do with eye movement that's making this memory be less this powerful. And so she began experimenting with people. She found that other people weren't able to move their eyes spontaneously like she had. And so she developed a technique where she held her hand up with two fingers raised and moved her hand back and forth in front of people and got them to move their eyes following her fingers. And so she began experimenting and then developed the therapy, and it became quite a far more standardized procedure over time as people reported back what they were experiencing and using. She taught it to other therapists. So now it's a standardized 8-phase procedure that addresses both the past memories, current triggers, and future fears.
Wow. We have a lot to owe that walk in the park, I guess.
I know, we do.
So I think, you know, to as Alice mentioned, her psychotherapist and her doctor both were skeptical. And I think that it might seem hard to believe that such a simple seeming mechanism can be so effective in treating such deeply disturbing traumatic memories. Also, as Alice mentioned again, it does sound a little woo-woo. And I'm wondering if EMDR has entered the mainstream and how much skepticism you face again amongst other therapists, doctors, or the public.
Well, yes, it really has entered the mainstream now. And it's recognized in the treatment guidelines all around the world, for example, by the International Society of Traumatic Stress Studies and the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, the American Psychiatric Association, the World Health Organization. However, there are people who are skeptical. And this really, when it first originated, people were very skeptical about the eye movements. They said, well, this is crazy. Like, you know, is this just some kind of weird placebo or hypnosis? And then research was done showing that it wasn't any of those things. But psychotherapy sometimes can be political, right? And people don't always want to look at the evidence that would challenge their own position. And some people just aren't informed to know that it has now such a strong research base.
And speaking of research, you know, sometimes it feels like we know an awful lot about the brain, but other times it feels like neuroscience is really in its infancy. And I'm just wondering if EMDR has unlocked more understanding about the brain, its processes, or set research going in a new direction.
Well, yes, actually, I think probably the first studies on the brain and psychotherapy were EMDR studies because people were curious about that. And now some other treatments are also using neurobiological studies and fMRIs and so forth to try to really understand what goes on in the brain. But it's complex because therapy is complex. And we don't necessarily really know other than that we can see there's a shift in the way that people think and feel following successful treatment.
And I'm wondering, you know, it is kind of new, relatively speaking. And do we know, for instance, if the effects of the therapy are lifelong or if people might need a tweak now and then? I'm not sure how extensively it's been studied.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's been studied very extensively. There's more than 30 randomized controlled trials showing that it's effective. And in these trials, EMDR is compared to other treatments that are effective, like some of the cognitive behavioral therapies, and also to treatment as usual and waitlist and on placebos. So it tends to show to be the very same as the other effective treatments, but far superior, so significantly superior to waitlist and treatment as usual. And the effects have been found to be maintained over long periods of time with follow-ups up to 3 years in some cases. The effects are not just specific to the memory sometimes, although that's usually what's looked at, but people will often describe a transformation of their sense of identity in themselves in terms of the process. So where Alice talked about feeling like a superwoman, some people might take that into their life and feel more efficacious or have more of a sense of agency or groundedness in themselves following treatment. So the effects tend to generalize greatly in terms of the person's life and their own sense of self.
That's fascinating. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Maxfield. That was clinical psychologist Louise Maxfield. She's a founding editor-in-chief of Journal of EMDR Practice and Research. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. At its peak almost 1,000 years ago, Cahokia Mounds in southwestern Illinois was the center of Mississippian culture. Tens of thousands of Native Americans called the thriving farming community home. But archaeologists have long said that by the 1400s, the site was abandoned due to floods, droughts, and a lack of resources. Now, a new study suggests that the abandonment was short-lived. By studying ancient fecal deposits, researchers have found that Native Americans repopulated the Cahokia area in the 1500s and were there until the 1700s. It was only then that migration, warfare, disease, and other factors led to a decline in the population. A.J. White is on the line with us now to share more from his research. He's a doctoral student in anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. A.J., welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, we are so glad to have you. Before we get to what your team found at Cahokia, I just wanted to find out, what were you taught about the site as a student studying archaeology?
Yeah, I'd say that along with, you know, most undergraduate archaeology students in America, Cahokia is brought up as this sort of example of how impressive American archaeology can be. You know, right in your home state is this real treasure of an archaeological site. You know, we're taught that it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, of which there are, you know, very few in the U.S. You know, there's almost always pictures that are shown of Monk's Mound. And, you know, I recall sitting and just looking at this, you know, you need to get an aerial view to entirely capture the extent of this massive earthwork, you know, that really just kind of takes your breath away, in the same way that looking at the Great Wall of China or the Great Pyramids of Giza do. And so, yeah, I'd say, you know, you marvel at it, and that's what sticks out in my memory the most.
And what do we know about the everyday life of the Native Americans that were at Cahokia during its heyday? And what time period would that have been?
Yeah, great question. So Cahokia, we know, started to develop around 900 AD or so, when people really started to gather around this area. And it's thought that by about 1100, it reached a population maximum. As you had mentioned earlier, perhaps into the tens of thousands of people. So you can kind of consider the 12th century to be, you know, its heyday, if you will, if we're just kind of judging by the amount of people that are there. And as to what life would have been like, you know, put yourself in what you know about city life and just kind of transport yourself back in time to this area. I mean, there probably wouldn't be people coming from far and wide. So there's been studies to show that it wasn't just only locals who are in this area, but there are people who came to the area from at least some significant distance. So just as, you know, any modern city today has people coming to it from many other places, you can think of Cahokia in a similar way. It would have been grand. I mean, there's public architecture in places where, you know, plazas and courtyards, and in the same way where if you walk down a city with skyscrapers, I think it would be similar to walking through these mounds. I mentioned Monk's Mound, which is the biggest, but there were dozens of other ones that, you know, got almost as large. So I really think that, you know, life in this time, it's fun to think about in terms of city living. And of course, it would have been different, but I think we have a place to start with knowing what urban life is like today.
And a lot of the language around Cahokia, Native American sites in general, have to do with the myth of the quote-unquote vanishing Indian. Can you talk a little bit more about that myth and why it is just that, a myth?
Sure. So this comes out of an academic concept, which gets at the way that Native American history has been presented to, you know, the larger American public. And when you think about your own schooling, you know, it's quite likely that you learned about, you know, the contact period. You know, so if you're in the East Coast, you know, you learned about the 1600s and what indigenous life was like at that point when Europeans just arrived in the scene. Maybe if you're in California, you learned a lot about indigenous life in the 1700s, also when, you know, Europeans first really arrived on the scene there. But after that point in time in the history books, you know, discussions of the Native American population in the country kind of drop out. And it the way I've kind of described it before is kind of as a simplification, just saying, you know, hello Europeans, goodbye Native Americans, once you reach a certain chapter. But the problem with that way of thinking, of course, is that there are several million Native Americans
today. So obviously it isn't as simple as a, you know, well, this group went away and another group came in that original place. It's this continued history, and it's a story that's not over. And I think academics have been drawn to decline stories, and you know, I've researched the you know, the Mississippian decline at Cahokia. I think it's fascinating. I think there's a lot to learn about it. The thing is, you know, do we end the conversation there? And at Cahokia, it does seem that the archaeological site of Cahokia was abandoned by about 1400 AD. I'm not trying to argue against that. What I'm trying to show is that there's this continued Native American presence and use of the immediate area around that that continues for hundreds of years after that point, and that doesn't get as discussed as much. And I think, you know, it's worth talking about so that we don't fall into that trap, you know, of just thinking, well, that's that. That's the end of indigenous peoples here. End of story. Right. Because it's not.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that that's because that's who is writing the history books are the Europeans.
Great point. And, you know, I'll point out that I'm not Native American, and, you know, many other academics are not as well. So I can't speak to that experience, but I can speak to the academic community and say that we haven't done the best job, you know, at portraying that history.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is A.J. White. He's a doctoral student in anthropology at the University of California in Berkeley. A.J. and his team recently published a study about Cahokia Mounds, which suggests that Native communities were in the area much later than archaeologists originally thought. Now, A.J., when I think of archaeology, I'm thinking digging up pots, weapons, jewelry, maybe. But for this study, your team was actually looking at something called fecal stanols, if I have that pronounced right. And I think that I know what it is from the name, but can you explain what they are and why they're important?
Absolutely. This is a class of molecules that we discussed that originate in our guts, and it happens from the breakdown of cholesterol. And so anytime that you have meat and you go out and you have a hot dog or something, the cholesterol in that meat is food not just for your stomach, but for the bacteria in it as well. And they want a piece of the pie, or in this case, hot dog. And so what they'll do is they'll try to break down the cholesterol, but it's a really complicated molecule. It's very strong and rigid, which is why it causes such a problem in our bloodstreams. And so anyway, so they can't completely break it down, but they alter it enough to make a new molecule, and it's called caprosinol. And caprosinol is something, you know, that is not wanted by your body nor your gut microbes. And so, you know, caprosinol with everything else your body doesn't want, it becomes poop. And it's something that we generate a whole lot more of this molecule than most other animals. And in some parts of the world, that can be a problem because how do we know that we're dealing with a city of people or some lost city of pigs? And in the case of Cahokia, we kind of can go around that because we know in a pre-European contact time period, those animals simply weren't there. And we can attribute, you know, this changes in these molecules over time to changes in the human presence. So the idea is the more of them we find in the lake mud right outside of Cahokia, we lead that to believe that there is more people at whatever that particular time is. You can kind of construct a population range. And one quick thing to your first point is that it's true that when you think of archaeology, you think of pots and, you know, digging holes in big ruins and things like that. But what's great about archaeology is it's kind of whatever you need to do to understand the past. And because there's been a lot of incorporation of chemistry and biology and geology, we're able to, you know, really expand what archaeology is. And I think that what we're doing here might be an example of that.
And what happened after Cahokia was vacated? What was going on in the Native communities during that time frame?
Okay. So, you know, let's start with the year 1400, where, you know, our fecal molecules show a population minimum, and most archaeological evidence shows the same thing. And that's kind of the point of abandonment. The first thing that we notice is that abandonment isn't particularly lasting. The general area seems to have an uptick in population by about 1500. So within only 100 years, there is a resurgence of population here. Now, we can't say exactly, you know, what specific groups were present at this time because we're just going off of these molecules. However, we can say we know it for certain to be a Native American presence of some sort, because this is still several hundred years before Europeans arrived on the scene. So we have 1500 is this time period where population starts building back up. And in the mid-1600s, another sort of population maximum is reached. This is still, you know, a time period where we can say this is certainly Native American. And it's not nearly as high as what we saw before during the Mississippian time period or the height of Cahokia. So it's modest, but it registers on our study. And what we did is we kind of said, okay, well, how can we fit this into what we know from other sorts of evidence? Because there's a lack of archaeological evidence, but does that mean that there's no one here? Well, let's find out. And so, you know, we have this mid-1600s height that kind of continues into the early 1700s. And we know from the first historical documentation in the area that the natives that were present around the site of Cahokia were the Cahokia tribe, and that's how Cahokia gets its name. And the Cahokia tribe was a subgroup of the Illinois Confederation, which of course is where the state name comes from. And so the Illinois had a way of life that was very different from the Mississippian time period, and people were better able to get around. They didn't stay in one spot the whole year. They hunted bison. So during summertime, they're looking for going on these big, bison hunting drives. And, at this time in the mid-1600s, we know that it seems there was an expansion of grasslands into the area around Cahokia, which might have been good habitat, for these animals. And therefore, it might have been a good place to live if you were a member of the Illinois Confederation. So we can't say with certainty that that's who it was, before we have those historical documents, but it kind of fits in until what we know is going on around that time period. We also know there was a lot of warfare and migration happening. So there's this, complicated network of alliances and enemies and battling and reasons that you'd want to kind of a reshuffling of people around the area. And this might be associated with that as well.
So even though we know a lot, there's so much yet to find out, it sounds like, from your research. I mean, it just sounds like you're a investigator, a historian, just ballpark. Like, what percentage do you think you know of what you want to know about the Cahokia Mounds?
That's a great question. It's like saying, how would you know every story that took place in Chicago or something? I mean, we have a city where there's, all sorts of things going on. What was the exact political structure? What were the exact religious beliefs? We can say a lot about, how people fed themselves and things that leave a record in the ground. But as to, what was happening inside of people's minds, which is oftentimes the most important thing that's going on when we study any human group, that's the most difficult to tease out. So I think there always will be discussion about, what was the political structure like at Cahokia, and, ideas of more philosophical beliefs and things about, how the world works. And we can get into it by finding, interesting artifacts that don't have utilitarian purposes. But there's so much there that there'll be enough discussion long after you and I are both gone. I'm convinced of that.
Okay, well, speaking of long after we're gone, I have to put you on the spot just because now that I know that cholesterol is good for something. What do you think future archaeologists are going to say about the fecal stanols of people in 2020 like you and me?
Well, I'm sad to say that they go to very specific places now because of this dang thing called plumbing that takes away all my fun. We because of the sewage systems that we have, this isn't going to make as much of an archaeological record. Perhaps if you were to go to like Yosemite or Yellowstone, a place where people are doing a lot of camping, and there's less toilets, maybe you'd be able to do like an archaeological study of people camping in the 2020s. But because of the sewage systems we have, it does kind of take that away from the landscape and makes this method that we're talking about a lot less likely to work.
Oh, darn. Well, AJ, thank you so much for being with us. A.J. White is a doctoral student in anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. A.J. and his team recently published a study about Cahokia Mounds in southern Illinois. We'll have more information about their research on our Twitter page. You can find us at 21STShow on Twitter. A.J., thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
That's it for us today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Julian Haida. Eunice Alpasan is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. I'm Gwen Maxey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.